is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Amharas and Eritreans will resort to defending their own interests if the federal government decides to ignore their interests.
That was Desalegn Chane, a member of Ethiopia's parliament from the National Movement of Amhara Party, in the need for wide representation and possible peace talks. Details coming up. Also, the ongoing drought devastating the Horn of Africa has hit Somalia the hardest. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The warring sides in Ethiopia appear closer to peace talks after Tigrayan rebels announced they were ready to attend Kenya-hosted negotiations. The statement came after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the government would form a committee to negotiate with the Tigrayan side. Henry Wilkins speaks to the government, politicians, and analysts about remaining challenges for peace talks in this report from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Prime Minister Abiy's announcement to lawmakers that a committee would be set up to negotiate with the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front is a sign that peace talks aimed at ending Ethiopia's civil war could be imminent. Analysts and lawmakers, however, have said that in order for negotiations to be effective, actors other than the TPLF and national government must be at the table. According to Desalegn Chane, a member of parliament with the National Movement of Amhara Party, this should include proper representation for the Amhara region and Ethiopia's northern neighbour Eritrea, both of which have played active roles in the fighting.
A peace process that does not ensure proper representation of all parties in the conflict is destined to fail. Amharas and Eritreans will resort to defending their own interests if the federal government decides to ignore their interests. I think Abiy should, understanding the legitimate concerns of the Amharas as well as the Eritreans, and invite them into the negotiating table.
He added that the government has not given assurance of this kind so far. Salamawit Kasser is the state minister for the Federal Government Communications Service. She told VOA that the committee will take over the whole process of negotiations.
The government has also formed a national dialogue commission to bring a broad-based, inclusive public dialogue that encourages a national consensus.
She went on to say Ethiopia.
They will also stand together to bring peace. The federal government has formed a committee to oversee the peace process in Tigray, and this effort ensures inclusivity of Ethiopians as a whole.
As for the TPLF, who will mediate the talks is vital, it seems. Its spokesperson said in a statement Tuesday that the leadership of the African Union Commission has yet to win back the rebel group's trust, and that the closeness of the AU's high representative to the Ethiopian Prime Minister has not gone unnoticed. On this basis, it said, we hold firm in the existing agreement among the parties to meet in Nairobi for negotiations hosted and facilitated by the President of Kenya. Analyst William Davison with the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based research body, said other factors beyond inclusivity and mediation will have to be overcome.
There are a number of outstanding issues that are obstacles to peace. I think first in line is probably the need to restore federal services to Tigray, particularly banking, telecommunications and electricity. Then there is the classification of the TPLF as a terrorist organization. But most of all, there is the issue of Western Tigray.
Amhara has said it will not relinquish control of the disputed region after taking it from the TPLF during the war, while the TPLF has said it must be returned. Ethiopian analyst Kiram Tadase says the economic climate in the country caused by the conflict and other factors including drought and cost of living may help push both sides towards peace.
If those involved in the conflict are not active in productivity or have less role in economic activities, the aggregate effect still be zero-sum game.
In his speech to lawmakers, Abiy said development is being hindered by the conflict. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Much of Tunisia slowed to a standstill today as the powerful labor union UGTT went on strike over government economic reform plans. Public transport grounded to a halt and flights were cancelled at Tunis' Carthage Airport. The union's walkout follows government proposals for a wage freeze and subsidy cuts, steps designed to yield a badly needed IMF deal for a $4 billion loan to ease the finance crisis in the North African country. A Reuters report indicates the strike is a new challenge to President Kais Saied as opposition to his rule mounts and a financial crisis looms. The strike is supposed to intensify pressure on Saied, who has tightened his grip on power since July 2021, when he froze parliament and sacked the cabinet, moves that his opponents have called a coup d'etat against Tunisia's young democracy. Saied has said he is just trying to counter political dysfunction and corruption. He hopes to put a new constitution to a referendum on July 25th. Meanwhile, Reuters reported that a central committee of Sudanese doctors said a protester was shot dead today during anti-coup protests in the Sudanese city of Omdurman. Demonstrations have continued in Sudan since a military coup in October. The ongoing drought devastating the Horn of Africa has hit Somalia the hardest, with an estimated 1.5 of its 16 million people facing crisis-level food insecurity. Aid groups say hundreds of thousands of Somalis are at risk of starving or death, as reports emerge of children dying of malnutrition. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
This stabilization center for malnourished children in Somalia is run by an NGO, Action Against Hunger. It serves mostly poor women living in IDP camps on the outskirts of Mogadishu. Fadumo Madey left Govgadud village, a rural settlement in the southern Somali Bay region, after three of her young children died of malnutrition. She now lives in an IDP campus with three of her remaining children.
Before the drought, we had livestock and farms that grew crops, but the drought destroyed them all at once. I had three children who died from malnutrition, and the child on my lap is suffering severe malnutrition because of the ongoing hunger crisis.
The large number of displaced women with malnourished children, most under the age of 5, is overwhelming for hospitals. Families escaping the ravages of drought from all regions of Somalia see Mogadishu as their only hope. Aisha Adam is from Sako town in Middle Juba.
We cannot grow crops and our livestock have died. The situation of our children as well as our lives are in dire danger. May God be with us.
Doctors say there is a risk of malnutrition that can cause more deaths if it is not addressed soon enough.
Dr. Abdirizak Yusuf works and supervises the malnutrition ward at the Martino Hospital, where he's also a director. He says there is a shortage of nutritional foods for children.
They must be given a therapeutic diet, such as milk, with nutritional value for the vital strength required for malnourished children. The supplies that were donated to us by the United Nations are depleted now.
Meanwhile, at an IDP camp just outside Mogadishu, women and their young children wait outside their makeshift shelters for help. And the camp's caretaker says families in desperate need of help arrive daily.
On a single day, 10 vans with displaced people can arrive. The next day, 4. Other days, we have no new arrivals. Every day has its own challenges. There is always something different. You can see families being dropped by vehicles all day, and they walk to this camp. That is the reality here.
Aid groups say the Somali government lacks the capacity to mitigate the severe drought and malnutrition crisis. And without more help, the situation will grow even more grim for children. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
The World Health Organization is procuring thousands of monkeypox tests for Africa, and it says it is working to ensure the continent has fair access to vaccines should the need arise. Monkeypox, a viral disease that causes flu-like symptoms and skin lesions, is endemic in parts of Africa, but this year there has been an increase in cases both on the continent and in the rest of the world. A Reuters report says Africa has documented 1,597 suspected cases of the virus this year, of which 66 have been fatal. 8 African countries now have confirmed cases, including Nigeria, Cameroon, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, where it is endemic, along with Benin and Ghana, where the virus is not normally found. More than 1,000 monkeypox cases have been reported to the WHO in the current outbreak outside African countries, where it more commonly spreads. The WHO plans to convene an emergency committee next week to assess whether the outbreak represents a public health emergency of international concern. Tensions continue to rise between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. The DRC High Defense Council, which advises the government on security issues, recommended canceling all commercial and diplomatic agreements with Rwanda because of allegations that Kigali backs the M23 militants in the eastern DRC. Yesterday, some protesters in Goma attacked people they suspected of being Rwandan, along with Congolese members of the Hutu and Tutsi ethnic communities. The Rwandan government denies that it supports the M23, a mostly Tutsi group that has launched several deadly attacks in the eastern DRC. Earlier this week, it seized the DRC border town of Bulangana. Reporter Jafar Al-Ketanti in Goma spoke with VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson about the latest developments.
There was a meeting in Kinshasa last night, what we call the Superior Council of Security, and they decided to inform the government to cancel all agreements signed between DRC and Rwanda, economical and also political. And as you know, later this year, the President Felix Tshisekedi and Paul Kagame signed many agreements, and some of them was economic. For example, he allowed that the gold of North Kivu, South Kivu, and Maniema must be treated in Rwanda, the process in Rwanda and not in DRC. So now all of those agreements must be cancelled because Rwanda is accused to support M23, which is killing people in DRC.
Now, yesterday there were some big protests in Goma and other places in the DRC in which people are accusing the Rwandan government of being involved in backing the M23 militants. I understand those turned violent. What happened?
Yeah. Yesterday, there was a protest in Goma. Locals were protesting against the Rwandan government, which is accused to support the M23 killing people in DRC. And during that protest, some Rwandan citizens which stay in Goma or come in Goma doing their business was attacked by protesters. But police was helping them, protecting them, and some people was very angry, attacked also some Congolese citizens, which are Tutsi. Like you know, there is many Tutsi and Hutu people in eastern Congo who are Congolese, but they speak Kinyarwanda. In the evening, the spokesperson of the North Kivu governor says, "We are in conflict against Rwanda. There is a conflict between DRC and Rwanda, and we are not in conflict with all Rwandese or all people who speak Rwanda.
That was Jafar Al-Katandi in Goma speaking by phone with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. M23 is one of the largest of the more than 100 rebel groups operating in the eastern DRC. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta yesterday called for the immediate deployment of a regional military force to halt the violence in the eastern DRC. Kenyatta is the current head of the East African Community, which has pledged to create such a force. However, no force has yet been established. And Jafar reported many in the DRC would be reluctant to see such a force if it included troops from Rwanda and Uganda. Both countries invaded the DRC in the 1990s. Former Ugandan presidential candidate Kizza Besigye has been charged a second time with inciting violence and remains in custody barely a week after being released on bail. As discontent has grown over rising prices in the country of 45 million, President Yoweri Museveni has repeatedly ignored calls for tax cuts and subsidies, urging citizens to live frugally instead. In his annual State of the Nation address last week, Museveni said cutting taxes and subsidies, especially on imports, is suicidal because people may buy carelessly and we may end up draining our foreign exchange reserves. A longtime critic of Museveni, Besigye has been leading protests against inflation, which has hit Uganda hard as food prices soar due to the war in Ukraine. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi recently called for an inclusive national dialogue, and preparations are underway to start the process in the first week of July. Some political parties see this as a golden opportunity to unite the country and confront all of Egypt's economic and political challenges. But some critics see it as a political stunt by the government to improve its image without seeking economic or political reforms. Mohamed Anwar El Sadat, president of Liberal Reform and Development Party, discussed the prospects of the national dialogue and the concrete steps needed for the real political reform with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi.
Definitely, the call for this national dialogue is a golden opportunity. This is something we all have been calling for, something we all have been wishing to happen. So we have to wait and see how serious they are and how ready they are willing to open up the political and the civil sphere. So let's be optimistic until time comes. You know that the first round of this dialogue will start in the beginning of July. So we are all looking forward to see this happening. You know.
Are you participating in this dialogue?
Well, so far I have not got an invitation, but we have been, as a political party, working on our views, our recommendations, to be ready until we receive the invitation, then definitely we will be part of it.
What are the concrete steps that you see needed if there is a real desire and political will to achieve a political and economic reform in Egypt?
You all know that Egypt is facing a lot of economic and social crisis, which representing a big challenge in the country. But for me, I see that the political reforms and the democratic transition and the human rights is a priority. And this is where I believe I will give much of my efforts, attention to talk about this. Because if we succeeded in this coming dialogue, to make sure that our constitution and rule of law is applied, I think that would open up a lot of opportunities where we can see free and fair election, where we can see a balance of power, where we can see separation of power. So my priority is the political reform. I think this will be the key for any other reforms happening in Egypt.
Why did you call for ending the arms monopoly and companies owned by the intelligence of economic activities as a major needed step to reform the economy?
Well, I believe this is something there have been a lot of reports, and even the government, Egyptian government and the president, they all realize that encouraging the private sector, encouraging the direct foreign investment, we have to create an environment where competition and equal chances, opportunities is given to everybody. No one have a monopoly or no one is exceptional. So we can see a real open and free market in Egypt. So I think what they have been announcing lately, it's towards this track, is encouraging private sector, trying to have some of the military companies in the stock exchange. I think this will all give a message of, let's say, trust and confidence to all those who would like to have investment in Egypt.
That was Mohamed Anwar El Sadat, president of the Liberal Reform and Development Party, speaking to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. The South African government has faced a barrage of criticism in parliament and in public about record high fuel prices in Africa's most industrialized economy. Petrol is going for an average of 25 rands per liter, equal to more than $6 per gallon. The ruling African National Congress, the ANC, blames the war in Ukraine, but opposition parties and citizens aren't accepting the explanation. Darren Taylor reports.
The government allocates billions of rands in fuel taxes to the Road Accident Fund, the RAF, to give financial help to people injured on South Africa's notoriously dangerous roads. But as Democratic Alliance DA leader John Steenhuisen highlighted in Parliament, corrupt officials are accused of often stealing from the RAF.
Fuel prices are high because government slaps on taxes. A full third of the fuel price is taxes that go to government. Taxes that pay for the incapable and corrupt state.
The debate about petrol costs happened shortly after Auditor General Tsakani Maluleke released a report on the state of local government in the country. She found that two-thirds of all municipal councils, mostly controlled by the ANC, were seemingly incapable of delivering basic services such as water and decent roads. They also could not account for money spent or unspent and failed to keep basic records. Public administration expert Harlan Kluter says much of the money raised by fuel taxes goes to local government budgets and is wasted or stolen.
It's a disgrace. It means that we've got people sleeping on the job. There's 18 municipalities that cannot account to any supporting documentation. So if I'm corrupt, then I do not keep track. There's no paper trail. It really points to the lack of political oversight.
The Economic Freedom Fighters Party says South Africans should be paying 13 rands a litre for fuel, not almost double this. It blames what it calls ANC corruption and greed. President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration is adamant it can't afford to lose the 140 billion rands it gets in fuel taxes annually. Steenhuisen disagrees.
We need to slash petrol prices now, and we can afford to do it. We can afford to do it if we get tough on corruption. If we slash the VIP protection budget, we can afford it. If we close failed state-owned entities, we can afford it.
The ANC says the whole world's suffering from rising costs of living. South Africans know that, but they want to hear a government plan to ease the pain. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.